All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing writer Natasha Bogutsky.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief Rich Dries. So, Rich, we have a lot to talk about covering the last two weekends at Tribeca Film Festival.
Yes, we do.
Let's
dive right into that. That's where we were last week, folks, why we didn't have the episode. As we mentioned 2 weeks ago, we were taking the weekend off to hit Tribeca Film Festival, which started last weekend. And literally
continued on to this weekend.
On through this weekend. We are recording on Sunday evening. We are literally just a few hours from having seen our last thing there. Some of the stuff that we saw and some of the red carpet interviews that we did will be showing up on Film Buff Online over the next week. There's a few reviews already up from last week. So we wanted to take time, though, to discuss a few of the movies that we saw that we really had some back and forth on as we were walking out of the theater for the most part.
And also do a little bit of debate, as I was told by a certain someone from Film Buff Online, save it for the podcast.
Yeah, because I knew, just I know you. I know how you feel about your opinions. No, I'm meaning this in a good way.
I know.
And I figured that, you know, we'd have some good discussion that hopefully will be illuminating for people who are listening.
Yes.
So let's dive into it and start off with the Martin Freeman starring film Cargo,
which will be coming up on Netflix very soon.
Yep, in a couple of weeks. Basically, Martin Freeman stars as a father of a baby girl trying to get her across the Australian outback to safety to some people who could take care of her after he has been bitten by a zombie and has 48 hours to live, basically, before he turns. Now, I think we talked about this 2 weeks ago on the last episode. We watched the trailer for that and a couple of other films that we'll be discussing. And we were both very excited about that. I mean, come on. Martin Freeman, zombie apocalypse, Australian outback. You have me. And the movie pretty much had me for most of it. However,
I did not like it. I did not like this movie at all.
Pourquoi?
Pourquoi? Because, one, it feels like the Martin Freeman show just as much as Darkest Hour was the Gary Oldman show.
Well, I mean, yeah, he's the star of the movie. It's going to center on him. I think he gives a great performance.
Oh, he does. He's one of the highlights of the film. Mm-hmm. But it felt as if characters were underdeveloped, particularly there were some aspects from the supporting characters in this film that were, like, for example, Riley, the wife of this gentleman that Martin saves out in the outback.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell she is being abused, but they don't really need to go into the fact that she is. The moment she walks out wearing what she is given their state, which, for the record, she looks like a 50s housewife, minus the makeup and the perfect hair. She is wearing the clothes of a 50s housewife. And it even goes to the point that not her husband, but the man who is keeping her.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that in the broadest spectrum, more or less, he stole her or kidnapped her or whatever.
Mm, well, rescued her with the expectations that she would be serving him.
I guess that's a...
Because she basically said he left the rest of that group to die. He's the only other survivor from that group.
There's and leaving them to die and then there's murdering
them? We should probably say right up front, there's probably going to be spoilers for Cargo and the rest of the films that we discuss. Not going to give too much away, but I do want to kind of do a little bit deeper dig than sometimes we do here on the show.
Yeah, there is leaving them to die.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty wording. But then she says, he locked them in a room and left them. That's not leaving you know, saving oneself by leaving everyone behind, that's actively murdering them.
True. Yeah, he's an awful person, but I think that's all you needed, and that she was being held hostage there, and the fact that he was kind of imposing that 50s housewife thing on him was him trying to mold her into what he desired. And when we first meet her, he has been rescued by Martin Freeman's character, and he, as a token of thank you, he's like, hey, come back to my place, you know, we'll get you some dinner and some shelter. Not knowing that Martin Freeman is infected and has this ticking clock going. When he arrives there and we first meet Riley, he gives her a string of pearls to wear, like he had gotten from somewhere, and she immediately takes it off and throws it away. But again, that's showing him molding her into this ideal 50s housewife kind of image that he wants her to be, oblivious to the fact that she's never going to return his affections or his... I don't think it's really affection. I think this is just, you know, possession. And he thinks he can just mold her that, you know, she's not a person. She is something to possess. And he's going to mold her like clay until she is exactly how he wants her to be, which makes him a horrible, despicable person. And I think that is the key point there as to why she's wearing that dress versus, you know, it seems ridiculous that she's wearing the dress. Yes, but Weirdo with the beardo was the one who's kind of forcing her into this.
No, I understand that. And I am all for that. It's the fact that they wait another 10 minutes, 11 minutes for her to outright state, he's not my husband. And she goes on this big, like, 2-minute spiel about that guy rescuing her and leaving everyone else to die and how badly he treats her. And we're sitting there going, no shit. We knew that 10, 11 minutes ago. The moment he tried to put the pearls out around your neck and mm-hmm. you look like you had this face of disgust. That's all we needed to know. Everyone knew from just that. It was the creepiness of the scene.
True. Now, was there anything else, though, that you didn't like about the film?
The timing of this film did not work.
I'll agree with you there. If you like watching Martin Freeman walk a lot in the Hobbit films, you are going to love this movie. Because there's a lot of shots of Martin Freeman walking across the Australian outback. And
you can obviously tell it's a drone. Obviously.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of drone footage. Beautifully shot. It looks wonderful. The outback looks gorgeous and stunning, and hopefully the Australian Board of Tourism kicked in a few bucks to this film's budget. But when you see him so isolated, way out in the middle of nowhere as a tiny dot, and there's nothing around, you're like, he's going to take days to cross this expanse. And the whole movie is basically predicated on the fact that it takes place within 48 hours. So there's a lot of walking and traveling that he does, and then it looks like, wow, he's got hours and hours and hours to go, and then the next time he looks at his watch, only 2 hours have passed since the last time he looked at his watch. It didn't
make sense.
It didn't feel right in terms of that interior logic to the film. And I will agree with you there.
By the way, props to the baby.
That is one chill baby that they had. the character of the baby that he's, you know, his daughter Rosie that he's trying to get to somebody was, you know, seems very chill during all sorts of horrific stuff. And the only time this baby makes a noise is when the plot demands a little bit of extra tension and they're trying to hide from something. And the baby then starts going meh or whatever. And you're like, oh, now the baby decides to make a noise. Now when they could very conceivably be killed in the next 30 seconds, that was a little contrived.
Yeah. But honest to God, though, props to whoever the baby actress was, because damn.
Anything else about Zoe? Anything else about Cargo?
We're not on Zoe yet.
I know. I'm trying to just move it along.
Yeah, I did not like it. I feel like there were really wonderful, good moments. There's a piece near the end where a character, an Aboriginal child, picks up a bottle of perfume and sprays it in front of him, kind of triggering a memory of his wife who passes away at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, that was a great moment.
There are some really good moments in this movie, but they're wrapped up in a crappy plot with bad writing and the timeline that does not work.
I'll agree with you about the timeline. I think the plot itself is a good plot. mostly you just have, you know, survivors trying to survive a zombie holocaust. This, you have a different spin on it where the father is trying to get his newborn child to safety before, there's that ticking clock. There's that sense of responsibility and everything. I like that twist. I'm not a big zombie film guy, but I don't think we've seen that particular iteration before.
I like that it's not overtly violent and overtly gory. It mm-hmm. focuses more on the character and their journey. And the zombie apocalypse part around it is just background fodder.
Yeah, if you're coming to a zombie movie looking for a lot of gore, you're not going to find it here. Most of it takes place off screen. You can fill it in with your imagination.
Really a lot of jump scares either.
No.
I think there was, what, maybe one, two?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this might disappoint hardcore zombie fans or hardcore horror fans. Movie. No, it's a survival movie that just happens to be set around zombies.
Yeah, it feels more low-key World War Z than anything else.
Mm-hmm. But moving on from Martin Freeman, star of one popular science fiction fantasy franchise, to Ewan McGregor, star of another popular science fiction franchise.
Hello there.
Hello there. Yeah. Sadly, he doesn't say that in the movie. Damn. Zoe. Just to give the setup for the film, I'm going to read right out of the festival guide here. In the not-too-distant future, the most cutting-edge technology has honed romantic relationships down to a science. A computerized test can determine the likelihood of successful partnership between two individuals. And androids, known as synthetics, have been designed as the ideal partners, one who will never leave. Zoe, Leia Sado, and Cole, Ewan McGregor, work in the research facility responsible for developing this technology, and it's against this backdrop of romantic engineering that their own relationship begins to blossom. But a sudden accident opens a division between them, threatening their nascent relationship and pointing to larger philosophical questions about love, humanity, and authenticity. I really liked this film.
As did I. This movie was brilliant, and it's going in the collection should it get distributed.
It does have distribution. I remember reading somewhere this weekend, and I apologize. Good. I don't have it at my fingertips to pass that along. One thing to note about Zoe is that one of the producers on this is Ridley Scott, who produced and directed, of course, Blade Runner, and then produced Blade Runner 2049. And I think this movie deals a lot with those same themes that he was exploring in those two films. Would you agree?
I would. One of the things that I noticed, and I briefly mentioned to you after we got out of the film, as much as I love Blade Runner, mm-hmm. and I think it is a genius piece of work, it's more style, whereas this is emotionally character-driven.
Oh, yeah. Blade Runner is very much a film noir story set in the future that explores these ideas. This is much more of an intimate character piece.
Yeah.
And
also deals with some strong morality issues as well, mm-hmm. such as guilt and seeing your partner the same way that you first saw them after a traumatic event. There's also the idea of the high that we get from romance and from love, and what would we do to have that moment over and over and over.
The fact that pharmacists have somehow
chemically
isolated that high and it becomes like a drug that people take was an amazingly interesting idea.
Oh my God, yes. They could have dumped the synthetic part of this film and done a movie just about that.
Oh God, yeah. That's a whole separate movie that could happen.
Yes.
And it's just a subplot here.
Yeah. And it's a brilliant piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really jealous that I didn't come up with it. When it comes to love and romance, I believe that when you do get with the right person, yeah, your body does create some sort of hormonal changes at that moment, mm-hmm. because you automatically, you can feel your heart beating faster, you can feel the blood rushing faster, the heat in your ears, which I get when I'm nervous, mm-hmm. but that's there. There are all different bodily changes that go on at that moment. And the fact that they were able to put that in a pill and have couples take it, I think the question that needs to be asked here is, one, why?
Mm-hmm.
And two, when does it get to the point in which you are so numb that that doesn't even work on you anymore? And what happens to you when that happens?
I know. Those are things that the movie suggests but never even gets to. I mean, yeah, there's so much material in here thematically that, you know, the director who also wrote this, Dave Dormus, if he wanted to do, you know, a sequel, that's where I would suggest he, you know, start exploring that, because this was amazing. And I'm glad it's gotten some distribution picked up recently, so it's going to get out there. I'm not familiar with Dormus's other films, but based on how strong this thing is, even if they're not like science fiction or whatever, I still want to go and track those down and take a look at them.
I've never seen his work, and I want to do the same. Can we talk for a second about the cast in this film?
Okay, because it's kind of nuts.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The background characters are, obviously, you have Ewan McGregor, you have Lea Seydoux, and you have Theo James as your main three actors, which is wonderful. Each one of them has been a part of a major franchise. Ewan McGregor is part of Star Wars. Lea Seydoux is part of the Bond films. And Theo James as the lead in Divergent. So, of course, you're going to stick notable names that have been in the public eye for some time in your top three. But the supporting roles, I'm sitting there for most of them going, I know them. I know them. And at one point, didn't I actually start giggling and hiding myself behind my Tribeca lanyard? As we had the supporting roles filled by Miranda Otto of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. She played Eowyn.
Mm-hmm.
And she was actually a fun character. Not fun as in I liked her. Fun as in she brought some wonderful ideas about morality and authenticity to the table in this plot.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly, Christina Aguilera.
And she was pretty good. I mean, it's a small role. It's not a flashy role.
No.
But it's kind of integral to
the plot,
to some of the ideas that are being discussed in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to kind of go any further than that. That's, you know, that's some stuff I want people to, I think, would be best discovering on their own when that scene rolls around.
And the one that I started giggling at was, if you're a fan of the TV show Criminal Minds,
yeah.
Dr. Spencer Reed, played by Matthew Gray Gubler, shows up at one point to just be a high hookup for the night for Lea Seydoux.
Mm-hmm. That was funny. I mean, I don't watch that. I was like, hey, that's the guy from the procedural show. And really, it looks like he just walked off that show and walked onto the set here. You know, same clothes, same crazy hair, the whole nine.
And it's funny because you didn't know that he voiced Simon the Chipmunk.
No, I didn't. But then again, the Alvin and the Chipmunk movies are terrible.
They are, but they're fun terrible. Come on, David Cross.
David Cross, man.
Jason Lee.
Jason. Guy's got to pay a mortgage, I guess.
Simon was always my favorite chipmunk, even in the cartoons.
And let's not leave out Rashida Jones and Zoe.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah, I forgot about Rashida. Oh, crap. Sorry.
Okay. But moving on from exploring possible future technology to a documentary that I was able to see that explored a little bit of the history of technology that is probably not known to many people. This was called General Magic. And it was about a small spinoff company from Apple in 1990 that started developing a small portable computing device, which once you start to see the specs that they had for this thing, you would realize, oh my gosh, these guys invented the smartphone about 15 years before the smartphone came out. It was a really fascinating doc. It's kind of short. It's about an hour and a half. It just kind of walks you through this story. There's a lot of talking head interviews where the people are looking back, and they don't look back with regret because so many of the people who worked for General Magic on this project went on to, start up eBay, worked on iPhone and iPod, worked, in other sectors of the Silicon Valley. It's a fascinating look. And even some of my friends who are big Apple, fans really didn't know this story because I, reached out to them and said, hey, have you ever heard of this? And they're like, no. And they're, just flabbergasted when I kind of gave them the capsule review of what this was. And they were just like, wow, that's really interesting. So that one is one definitely if you're interested in things that almost happened that changed how we lived, but missed it by 15 years, right idea, wrong time kind of a thing. I would recommend, keeping an eye out for General Magic. That's going to be one that I think a lot of people are going to be interested in.
The company was formed in 1990 and defunct it in 2002. So here's a good question for you.
Okay.
Do you think it might have been the post 9/11 world in which...
No, this company was pretty much dead in the water by the mid-90s. They shipped one generation of product. It barely sold. Most of the units that sold were bought by people who either worked for the company or their families. The product didn't anticipate the World Wide Web so much. All the apps and everything that were on it all worked through a proprietary cloud. So that didn't, that was just, I believe, AT&T set up. And, so anybody else had any other device, any other cell service or anything like that wouldn't be able to access this thing. They had to go through AT&T. There are a couple of design flaws or flaws in the product itself, in the setup, that really kind of doomed this thing. I think the company was dissolved in 2002, but for several years it just kind of existed as a legal entity only.
Okay.
But moving on from a documentary, I think everybody, people who are fascinated with technology and the history of technology would probably want to take a look at, to another documentary that deals with a hidden bit of Americana history. This one goes back into the mid-50s through the 70s. It's called Bathtubs Over Broadway and shows and highlights the history of industrial musicals and one man's journey as he discovers these things and kind of goes in and begins to explore this kind of hidden, almost vanished piece of American musical theater history. What did you think? You weren't too much of a fan of the actual music, though, were you?
No one should ever mix ads and show tunes together. Oh, and they're not all show tunes. Some of it's disco music. Some of it's like 70s funk.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you have the guys who wrote
Cabaret
or Fiddler on the Roof writing these musicals for sales conferences, touting, for 30 minutes that are going to tout the benefits of silicon or bathroom fixtures or, Firestone tires, stuff like that.
Well, my answer to that is they needed the paycheck.
Well, yeah, they did. But they're still going to give it their all. They're still going to be professional about it.
True.
And you're going to get some great music, I think, that just if you take out the lyrics about bathrooms and substitute like a love song or something, probably would have been a hit, a Broadway show tune hit.
No, you're right. It would have. But I can't get past the lyrics once you've heard it with the background music.
Okay, fair enough. I just thought it was a fascinating story about how Steve Young, the David Letterman Late Show staff writer who was kind of tasked with finding all those weird albums from the old Dave's record collection comedy bits that they used to do, how he discovered these cast albums for these things that were maybe pressed for a couple of 100 copies and handed out to salespeople as like souvenirs from the sales convention in Lake Tahoe or whatever. And they kind of like show up in record stores every now and then, used record stores. And there's a very small group of aficionados for this kind of stuff. But it's weird because, I mean, the movie takes you into that, and it's like the drummer for the Germs, Jello Biafra from The Dead Kennedys is a big fan of this kind of stuff.
There's a great little shot that I love in the film where something catches his eye.
I mentioned that peeks over his shoulder too.
With this quirky smile on his face.
He kind of looks, he has this, wait a minute, is that? And then his smile gets even wider.
Yeah.
And it's just that moment of discovery that they were able to capture, which was fantastic. And I believe the director of this film got one of the awards at Tribeca for first-time director documentary. It was fascinating. Okay, and going from fascinating to disappointing.
Oh, God.
One of the other films that we said we were looking forward to in our last episode was a biopic about Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, A Modern Prometheus, the original novel upon which half a billion horror movies have been made. And it looked really good. We had Elle Fanning as Mary Shelley.
Douglas Booth as Percy Blythe Shelley. Mm-hmm. Maisie Williams, Joanne Froggatt from Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm. You know, a great cast. It looked luscious. It had some strong reviews coming out of Sundance, I believe, too.
Why?
And I thought it was a disjointed mess.
It was! There were moments I'm sitting there going, what? What? Why? What was that?
I really wanted this thing to be, you know, and you shouldn't review a movie about what you wanted, but what it is. I had the feeling that this movie was supposed to be this kind of very pro-feminist Mary Shelley doing her thing because she's a woman and bucking the conventions of society.
Well, that's the marketing talking,
yeah.
Because that's what the trailer feeds into.
Mm-hmm. And you get some of that. You definitely get a little bit of that.
The problem is it's not delivered good enough for it to be believable.
No. And they kind of just, it feels very like mini episodic bits here and there to the point where it feels like they're just checking bits of her life off a list. It's like, okay, she goes, lives in Scotland, meets Percy, check. Now she goes back to London, check. Now she's pregnant, check. Baby dies, check. And it just kind of goes through all mm-hmm. of that like that. And it didn't really flow as a narrative to me.
The editing
at all.
In this was incredibly choppy.
Mm.
Yeah. There's a shot where it goes to black and then we see it scroll like the camera panning to the right to her and then it goes to black and then they decide to come back up on something else but the camera is doing another move and then they go to black again and
yes.
then they're outside and I'm like, what is going on with this editing? It's
horrible scenes just kind of end. They don't go from one scene, they don't transition from one scene to another. There's nothing there that kind of like gives a flow and an ebb to the narrative. It's just like, here's a moment, fade to black, here's a moment, fade to black,
yes.
Here's a moment, fade to black. And another thing, too, what was really kind of, there was like some really bad continuity errors in like early on in the movie. Somebody, you know, a character hands another character something, and you see them hand that. Cut back to the first character saying something, and then they cut back to the second character, and they're like stooping over to pick that thing up off the floor. We never see the character drop it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like vital. It's like, what were they trying to put it down on the floor? And then they started to stand back up. You know, you don't understand what's happening there. It just looks wrong. You lose that continuity of action there.
There are shots of ridiculous things. Like when it cuts to black, I think on the third time when we came back up, we got a shot of a chandelier.
Oh, it was a lovely chandelier. I have no idea why that was the beginning of that shot.
Why it was the only
sequence.
Shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or later on, right after her baby dies, Percy is talking to her and he says, remember, she wasn't long for this world. Okay, we know that the baby just died. You pretty much just stated that. And then they lingered. They didn't even pan over to it. They just dropped the camera pretty much on the empty cradle.
Mm-hmm.
And then lingered on it for, what would you say, at least 4 or 5 seconds.
Yeah.
It felt like
empty
a lifetime
cradle,
just watching.
Empty cradle, people. Her baby's dead. Yes
you just told
you,
us
thank
that.
Thank you, we got it.
Yeah. And then she's dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the cradle empty again. And then she gets up and goes over to it and picks the baby up.
And honestly, the film...
That part works. But then we cut back to it and they linger.
Honestly, though, I'll disagree with you there because honestly, the film kept jumping around in time, moving forward, you know, in bits and not really letting you know that it was doing that. It just kind of was like randomly like, oh, here's a scene. And then maybe 3 scenes later, we hear that it's like 2 years from, you know, 15 minutes ago or whatever. So suddenly, you know, she's staring there looking at the sad, sad empty baby cradle. And then suddenly we cut and it's like, it's bright out. She gets up and she looks and, oh, there's a baby. And I'm thinking, did we just jump forward a year and now she's had another child?
Mm-hmm.
I honestly didn't get it was a dream until they, you know, the typical shock cut to her waking up back in dreary, you know, the dreary apartment that they were living
in. It's jumpy. But the music and the coloring of the scene showed to me that it was a dream.
Okay, because I just figured, oh, they moved somewhere nicer, and it's sunny, and she had another baby, so it was probably another year down the
line.
She
was still in the same sleeping position as she was when Percy walked out of the room.
Okay, I missed that.
But the lighting had changed. The fire was a lot more brighter, and it was a lot more red mm-hmm. and orange coloring in the room to symbolize the warmth. And then we hear the baby crying and she got up.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't flow. It was still kind of choppy. But at that moment, I could, between that and the score that they mm-hmm. had in the background, you could tell it was very dreamlike.
And can I just say one of my pet peeves shows up in this movie?
And what is that?
Well, you have like any time in a film that's kind of a period piece set in like the 16, 17, 1800s, something like that, where...
Oh, I know what it is.
Where, you know, it's like, this is a house. And in modern times, that house would look very old. But why is it looking old when it's period correct build for that time? You know, it's like, this house was built in 1750 and this movie takes place in 1754. Why does it look like a 250-year-old house then? It should look like a 4-year-old house. It's like movies set in the Renaissance where all the books are kind of dusty and look like they're falling apart. No, they should be brand new and look pristine. It's 600 years later when they should look dusty and falling apart. There's so much in this movie that looks like it's all falling apart and it's really super old when in that time period it should be looking new that it really distracted me.
Okay, yeah,
it is one of my pet peeves, and it drives me berserk when I see it.
Also, I understand that she never had a relationship with her mother, and because her mother died giving birth to her,
mm-hmm. as the movie told us over and over and over again.
Yes, it gets to a point where you're sitting there going, "Okay, how is this helping the plot?" They reference her mother so much, and yet we never see her once through a flashback. It never actually sets in. It feels like it's only ever skin deep.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the wording in this is, I applaud films like, for example, The Witch, who use period language in order to tell their story,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like they were slightly trying to do here, and failing horribly at it because they don't know what they're doing when they were writing.
Well, I don't think, you know, they really kind of did a flashback with Mary's mother because the film is kind of basically told from her point of view. And as she said, you know, my mother died when I was 10 years old, 10 days old. So there were other dream sequences, but I don't think, you know, Mary would have had any kind of concrete memory at all if her mom only died when she was 10 days old. So I don't think she would have had the material to do that for a dream or any kind of flashback like that. That part didn't bother me. It's just the fact that she had to drop this like every 5 minutes in the first half hour of the movie.
And then on top of it, her mother's grave is a setting for a meetup between two lovers. I did love the scene in the church, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was a great scene. That was a fun scene. There was some energy there.
It's not just energy. There's also this rebellion that in that scene is the only time I truly felt it. That they're acting recklessly. They don't care. Little bit of clarity. They broke into a church because they're just trying to get out of the rain. But they decide, I'm going to take off with the communion wine and drink it right from the chalice.
Yeah, if you have any kind of religious background, then you're probably going to go, whoop, hello. but that's fine.
There are the idea of ideas in this of being rebellious and acting against the societal norms of the time, causing scandals, having marital relationships, like open relationships and free love and feminism. There's just so much that they tried to pack in and they didn't structure it properly.
Yeah, narratively it fails, so you can't really explore any of the themes well. It was disappointing. It was a disappointment.
How about that ending? Is it just me, or was it so predictable that you predicted it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've seen a lot of biopics, you're kind of guessing, okay, I know how this one's going to end.
Well, for example, she doesn't have the last name Shelley yet, so obviously, when they're walking down the road, we're going to walk past a bookshop, and there it is, and her name's finally on it.
Mm-hmm. And, figures. And it, you know, you get a bunch of title cards explaining what happens to Percy Shelley, to Mary Shelley, to Lord Byron, and then a couple of other characters who you're like, I don't even care.
By the way, Lord Byron was probably the one character I would have wanted. I feel like the movie should have been more about Lord Byron. I would have gone to see that. Because he was fun. He had some interesting ideas that I think made him, is there a bastard of a character? However, mm-hmm. He was interesting.
True. But let's kind of move on from Mary Shelley, because it's why I spend a whole lot of time talking about this movie. It comes out in May. And
May 25th.
And honestly, neither of us are recommending it.
No.
It's just not a mess. It's not worth your time, honestly, folks. But I did catch a couple of films that I thought were worth your time. I was able to spend a few more days on site than Natasha for the fest. So I caught, first off, Ethan Hawke and Noomi Rapace in Stockholm, which is a film that explores the bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, that gave birth to the psychiatric idea of Stockholm Syndrome, where after a certain amount of time, people who are being held hostage or captive begin to identify with their captors. If that whole idea sounds a little familiar.
Beauty and the Beast, folks.
Well, yes, Beauty and the Beast. Dog Day Afternoon was, you know, based on that incident as well. They just moved it to a bank in New York City and put in Al Pacino. Is Ethan Hawke Al Pacino? No. But he does a great job in the role. He's very fun. The director keeps the action moving along. Noomi Rapace is marvelous.
When isn't she?
That's true. There's a great scene early on where after, you know, everybody's been taken hostage, the bank's been taken over by Ethan Hawke's character, the police are outside, and they bring in Noomi Rapace's husband, and she's basically like, look, you don't need to be here. Go home, feed the kids, and then she starts to give him the recipe for how she makes fish for the kids. And everybody's standing around looking at her like, what in the world are you doing? But apparently, I believe this actually happened during the robbery. And it's a really neat moment. And I think that says so much about her character and the way she did it in that moment. Again, Stockholm should be coming out fairly soon in the next couple of months. I apologize. I don't have the date on me, but it's fantastic. Another great movie. And I'm going to have to go to the festival program here to get the full name of this. The Seven Stages to Achieve Eternal Crap.
Would you like me to do it? Because I've been practicing.
Sure, go ahead.
The seven stages to achieve eternal bliss by passing through the gateway chosen by the Holy Storch.
Darn, girl.
I've been practicing it. I'm so proud.
This movie was insane. Insane in the best possible way. And the only way I can really kind of even explain this plot is, again, just going to the press book and reading out the actual description. Quote, looking to make a splash in the big city, Claire, played by Kate McCucci, and Paul, Sam Huntington, relocate from Ohio to Los Angeles. They quickly score a posh new apartment with unbelievably cheap rent. So far, according to plan. But what appears too good to be true, in fact, is. As it turns out, an enigmatic guru, Taika Waititi, committed suicide in the apartment's bathtub. Even worse, an endless string of enthusiastic cultists routinely break into the couple's homes to ceremonially off themselves in his honor. Unable to afford another move, Claire and Paul find themselves growing increasingly fascinated by the cult's anti-mortality beliefs. This movie was, oh my gosh. What was interesting about this movie was, this is a really quirky, oddball movie with some really dark, dark moments. And it, I'll tell you right now, it's not for everybody. It is not for everybody. I sat in the back of the theater during this screening, and there were somewhere between 5 and 10 walkouts at various points, which I was really interested by in the fact that I was like, okay, are these people who just, like, you know, overlapped screenings, or are they just ducked in for part of this and wanted, you know, because they were just killing time before something else? Or, oh no, this is, I could see why some people would be walking out on this moment. It was really amazing. There's some great cameos from comedic actors. Mark McKinney from Kids in the Hall shows up. Dan Harmon, creator of Community and co-creator of Rick and Morty, is in this film as a police detective who keeps coming back to the apartment. He knows the whole history, and he's just like, okay, where's another dead cultist for me to process?
Isn't Taika Waititi the director of Thor Ragnarok?
Yep, as well as What We Are in the Dark, the great vampire movie. Remember, we're werewolves, not swearwolves.
Oh, God.
I love that line. And he also was the director of Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, really?
Yes. So he shows up, and he does a really good Southern Californian accent in this. You know, I'm kind of like, I know this is Taika Waititi, but he does not sound New Zealand today. So that is, you know, one I would strongly recommend. I don't want to give too much more of it away. You know, comedies are, you know, like certain other genre films that have a lot of twists or rely on the element of surprise that I don't want to give too much away, but oh my goodness. Oh, and Dana Gould shows up as Kate McCucci's boss, and there's a couple of really fun moments with him, but I'm a big Dana Gould fan, so, you know, the guy could show up and, you know, read me the cast and crew credits from Planet of the Apes, and I would be entertained. And of course, it's Dana Gould, so he probably has those memorized because he's a big Planet of the Apes fan. And the last film I saw on my own was The Seagull.
Jealous, by the way. Oh my God, I wanted to see that movie.
You will enjoy it. I will. I'll tell you that right now. I think you will really like it. It's based on the...
Do you know if it has distribution yet?
I believe so, yes. It's based on the Chekhov play. They managed to open it up a little bit, so some of it takes place on the grounds of the old Russian house, out on the lake, and the area around. It's not very, it doesn't feel stage-bound at all. I'm not very familiar with Chekhov's work, outside of, you know, when he's helmsman on the U.S. Enterprise.
Hey,
I know.
That was bad. Come on.
Come on. I'm not going to let that joke go by.
Instant Chekhov, Pavel Andreevich. All right, check up. Pavel Andreevich.
But
looking for the nuclear whistles. Whistles. What? Whistles.
And the only other thing I know about Chekhov is, of course, the, you know, the Chekhov's gun maxim that if you place a gun on a mantle in the first act of a play, someone has to fire that gun in the third act. You know, it's just like, oh, look at this thing here. Obviously, that's going to become important at the climax of your story.
I'm only familiar with his Uncle Vanya.
Okay, that, again, Uncle Vanya I'm not familiar with. But what was funny was, I'm watching this film, and it's very funny. You know, people think, oh, Chekhov, Russian playwright, must be very dour, and everybody sit around in our hovels as the winter comes from September through June here in Russia, and we eat one potato that whole time.
That's not bad. No, your accent.
Oh, thank you.
It needs work, but the joke
wasn't very good, but the accent was okay.
Yeah, the accent
Thanks.
Was good. Yeah.
Anyways, so I wasn't very familiar with Chekhov at all, but I found the play very funny and very witty. And another thing, too, I can definitely see now, kind of reverse engineering it, the influence Chekhov has had, especially this play, The Seagull, has had on some of the works of Woody Allen.
Love and Death.
Love and Death, exactly. One of my favorite Woody Allen films. Suddenly I'm sitting there going, oh my God, that's where he got this bit here and this bit here. I was chuckling in recognition at some of the stuff. And it's actually a great, great film, though. It's very well done. Annette Bening is fantastic in this thing. Saoirse Ronan is wonderful. It's a great cast.
Elizabeth Moss
is, oh my God, Elizabeth Moss does deadpan some stuff. That is brilliant.
So I'm guessing her role is more comic relief, more lighthearted comparatively to what she's doing right now in The Handmaid's Tale?
Yes.
Tell us a little more about it.
Why are you wearing black? I'm mourning. Who died? My life. You know, it's just like, so, oh my God, this is good. It's like, and
it was in the trailer, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was in the trailer. And actually, I'm just making this mental connection now. I really want to go and find out if Ally Sheedy's character in The Breakfast Club is based on this character in some way or influence, because it's so similar. I don't know if that was an actual thing or not, but I want to find out if it is. So look for that. Another film that we both got a chance to see that I thought was fantastic. I believe you did too. We didn't talk about it too much because we were kind of hustling off to something else. The Miseducation of Cameron Post. This was a film where basically Chloe Grace Moretz is playing a young girl in high school who goes to prom and gets caught having sex in the back seat of a car with another girl. And since it's 1993 and she lives with her aunt who is very religious, she gets shipped off to a Pray the Gay Away camp.
Run by Jennifer Ely.
Yep. And it's just basically her trying to deal with that, watching. These kind of conversion therapy things really make my skin crawl. I've always had that reaction to it. It's like, no, it's their nature. It's not their nurture.
I didn't even know these existed until a few years ago when I was watching a television show I'm quite fond of called Boston Legal. Mm-hmm. And there's a judge on the show who thinks that was going to help him because he was gay and he's in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And so he living at home with his mom, and he's just like, I'm going to go to this, and maybe it might be able to help me. And I'm sitting there going, that's a thing?
Yeah, well, they were a thing. You know, this, like I said, this movie set in 1993, and thank God. I mean, it's interesting to see that in 25 years, the kind of cultural shift we've had where this idea of conversion therapy has been rejected as the quackery that it is by 99.97% of people. And there's still some, you know, crazy fringe religious folks who are like, oh no, we can, you know, if you just pray hard enough, you'll suddenly, you know, like, you know, want to have sex with members of the opposite sex instead of the members of the same sex.
It will fix you. Yeah.
It will fix you. Which always, you know, which operates under the false impression that these people are broken, which they're not. You know, it's kind of like her trying to, you know, survive this thing that she's being put through, and she finds a couple of other
ragtag initiates.
Yeah, two others who are also just kind of rebelling against this whole idea of being there. Everybody else is kind of like fallen into this sucker trap or trying to convince themselves that this is working. and it's not.
Can we just quickly state that one of the characters' names is Jane Fonda?
Yes, which is delightful, and she's amazing. That character is amazing.
Yeah, she was.
It's a great film. Again, it's something I'd rather let people kind of discover the journey that these characters go on because it's so well done.
You got me to go see it just because you said John Gallagher Jr. was in it.
Yes. He's really good too. And yeah, and as I sat there and I was kind of watching it and I was, you know, really reflecting on it, I was like, okay, my age in 1993 and my age now, and I was thinking, wow, this is a great movie just as a historical marker to show, like I said, how far we've come in just a quarter of a century in understanding that, you know, these are just people who have different wants and desires than other members of society, and that's not wrong.
No, it's not.
No. And there's a great line that Chloe Grace Moretz has when the state social welfare person shows up, and as she has a whole thing with him, and then goes back to the director of the camp. And basically, he's like, why is the cure making me hate myself? Why is that considered a cure? I don't want to feel like I have to hate myself. And, you know, that speaks, I think, volumes. Volumes. And finally, I think we're going to hit on the film that we both liked the most.
Yes.
Out of all the stuff that we saw.
Which we saw
the festival.
Actually last week.
Yes. And that is the debut writing and directing effort from Doctor Who actress Karen Gillan, and it's called The Party's Just Beginning.
The original title of this movie was called Tupperware Party?
Mm-hmm.
And that was just an odd choice, whereas once you see this film, you'll understand why the name change, and also you'll hate the name change because it makes your skin crawl.
Yeah. Yeah. At one point, the words, "the party's just beginning," is a line of dialogue in a scene that is very uncomfortable to watch. But this whole movie is
uncomfortable
is
to watch.
Uncomfortable to watch in a very good way. It's a yes. dark movie. It's about a woman who, a year on, is still unable to process and cope with a friend's suicide. She self-medicates a lot with drugs, with alcohol, with anonymous sex with strangers.
Chips.
And then tops the evening off by walking home, shoveling French fries into her face.
Yes. Very much like an animal at that point. She's mm-hmm. not being nice about it. She's full on shoving them in.
Yes. And, you know, it's just her slowly taking those first steps towards ultimately dealing with this. We're not going to follow her on that whole journey. But by the end, you know, this is a movie about her just, you know, her complete slide down.
Her spiraling out of control despite trying to find some sort of meaning. And I would say, yeah, she is trying to find some sort of meaning to put her back together. Mm-hmm. She ends up helping two other characters out. One of them is a man by the name of Dale, who is going through a midlife crisis, played by her co-star from Guardians of the Galaxy, Lee Pace.
Mm-hmm.
Looking very much unlike Ronan the Accuser.
Well, he doesn't have a crap ton of makeup and ridiculous costuming on. Although, the beard is a little bit...
I like the beard.
Kind of ridiculous, too. I'm sorry. Lee Pace is always, first and foremost...
Ew, Pushing Daisies.
The pie man from Pushing Daisies. So...
Ooh.
anything beyond that, yeah. Anything beyond that is like, oh, okay, why is this elven king not making pies for the hobbit here?
No, I like the beard as a character choice, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Not because, oh, Lee Pace, he's so gorgeous, he should lose the beard. No, no, no. I like it as a character choice because he is also someone who is out of control and is a complete and utter mess. Not so much to the point that she is.
Oh, certainly not.
But
he has his own problems.
He has his own problems, yeah.
I also like the beard, too, as a character choice. Just because a beard hides your face
mm-hmm.
and hides your identity.
Exactly.
And the movie, he doesn't, they hang out for a good couple of days, and neither at no point whatsoever do they tell each other their names.
Nope.
And they make it a point as he's starting to leave, they're like, oh, by the way, what's your name? you know, I'm not telling you. And, you know, that was great, you know, because I was just like, mm-hmm. did they just introduce each other at some point and I missed it or the movie missed it? And then suddenly at the end, it's like, you know, they've both been hanging out for how long and they don't even know each other's names. That was great. I love that part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Karen actually pulled this from her own experience as a child. Mm-hmm. One of the other characters is an old man who accidentally calls her house thinking that he's calling a helpline, a suicide helpline, mm-hmm. because the number of the helpline and the number of her house are one digit off, which was something that actually happened to Karen as a child mm-hmm. in real life. Apparently, she said in our Q&A that a woman called the house and ended up actually making friends with Karen's mom and they went to bingo together.
Yes. And that same idea is played out in the movie with an old man whose children have gone off and are starting to raise their own families and he doesn't hear from them. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing where, you know, this, because honestly, her character is not that likable.
No.
She's interesting. And that's why you're watching her and you're, you know, through flashbacks, you're learning about the death of the friend and everything. But mostly, she is a nasty piece of work.
Yeah.
You certainly wouldn't want to be friends with her now, you know, in the current present of the movie. Except for when she, for some reason, doesn't hang up on this guy. And they start to form a friendship just over the phone. They never meet.
She lies and says her name is Charlotte.
Yes.
So, in a way, they never tell their names there either.
True. And it's all very sweet and touching, and I, you know, I don't want to say how it all ends, but, you know, that is kind of like one of the catalysts for
her hitting rock bottom.
I thought you had a really good question for Karen Gillan in the Q&A, and I'm going to preface this by saying we also got a red carpet interview with Karen for about 5 minutes, and that piece will be coming up this week on the site. But beyond that, you know, and we went into the red carpet. You went into the red carpet interview. You did it.
Yes,
were wonderful.
My first one.
I know.
I was very proud.
You went into that not having seen the movie. And then you came up with a great follow-up question to ask in the Q&A afterwards. And what was it?
I believe I asked her, does the character of the caller and of Dale help Lucy, who is the name of her character, or do they push her deeper into herself?
And what was the answer?
She said both.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of, you can see that when you watch the movie, you can see, yeah, definitely I can see, you know, with that in mind. And I think that, you know, again, this is some solid screenwriting on Gillan's part. And it's some solid filmmaking on her part as well. This is a movie that could easily have gone wrong.
A million different ways.
But she is so rock solid with keeping the tone throughout the film. There's just a little bit of humor here and there to keep you kind of hooked in.
Which annoys the crap out of me because this film is being categorized as a comedy, as a dark comedy. It is not a comedy at all.
I don't think it's a dark comedy, no. Just because it's dark. It
yes.
definitely is dark, and it has a couple of comedic moments which punctuate and kind of deflate things, give the audience a moment to breathe. You go, ah, okay, that was
this
cute.
This is a drama.
Yeah, it's definitely a drama. I don't think I'd consider this a dark comedy, and I'm not sure who in the programming department at the festival thought such a thing.
No, it's not even at the festival. Rotten Tomatoes, Wikipedia, IMDb.
Oh, they're probably all picking up the same thing. So,
Probably coming out of Glasgow where it premiered back in February.
Mm-hmm.
No, this film definitely for me takes the top of the heap. Everything about it. I have personal experience with the subject matter, which deepened my connection to this film a lot more than I had anticipated when I walked in. Mm-hmm. When I walked in, thinking there, I'm going to be able to handle this. This is, and then it got started. And within the first 5 minutes, I'm going, oh God. Within the first hour, I'm starting to tense up in my seat. I think I was like playing with a strap on my, my journal that keeps it shut. And then during the second half, I'm a blubbery mess. The fact that her directorial and her writing debut was able to elicit that sort of response from me, I would say that's a good sign.
Yes, yes. It's like I said, it's amazing work. And out of everything that we saw, this is the one I think we're in the strongest agreement on. When this gets picked up, they're still looking for distribution on this in the U.S., but hopefully somebody will, you know, snatch this up, because there was a lot of good buzz about this film. Everybody, you know, we talked to had either was like, oh yeah, that was great, or oh yeah, I need to see that. I've heard nothing but good things about it. So fingers crossed, this is one of those films that gets picked up and, you know, made available for everybody, because wow, it's just some amazing filmmaking.
As long as it doesn't land on a streaming service.
Well, this is an intimate enough character portrait that if you saw it just at home on TV, it probably still works. Seeing it on the big screen, though, I think, you know, always has more of a impact.
It does, but once it disappears into the background of the Netflix originals, do you think we'll ever actually see a physical copy on the shelves in a store? That's why.
Depends.
Because I feel this film needs a wider distribution based off of its merit alone.
Mm-hmm. And let's face it, you want a copy for your shelf.
Damn straight. This one goes before Zoe.
Wow. That's a strong recommendation. And on that note, though, I think we're going to wrap up for this week. Remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes and Stitcher. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review, because that always helps us connect with new listeners.
And we will be back next week with the latest news and the success story of Marvel Studios. And that is right here on the Big Picture Podcast.